Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual. It was a photo finish for the good martini today. The one that did not win but deserves a quick mention is that the maker of the really badly produced YouTube video, The Innocence of Muslims, that Obama and Hillary Clinton blamed for the terrorist attack on Benghazi, saying it was this spontaneous riot that got out of control, and, you know, that obviously wasn't the case. Then, of course, the feds swooped in to make sure he got hit with a probation violation and was sent to the pokey for just about a year, Jim. So he's out today. Some would consider him a political prisoner.
I understand that it was U.S. Attorney Emily Letella who just made the statement, never mind. Oh, you weren't responsible for that after all. Sorry about those past couple months. Sorry about the fact you're going to have to live in hiding. Sorry about the fact that we tried to claim that you were responsible for the deaths of four Americans, when in fact it was, you know, the perpetrators and our own bad decisions on embassy security and failure to send a rescue mission and things like that. Sorry about that. Carry on.
The winner comes from the New York Times. And this in and of itself is not great news, but it's coming at a good time in the Obamacare debate. And it's hopefully opening the eyes to a lot of people. This from Sunday's New York Times. Federal officials often say that health insurance will cost consumers less than expected under President Obama's health care law. But they rarely mention one big reason. Many insurers are significantly limiting the choices of doctors and hospitals available to consumers. From California to Illinois to New Hampshire and many states in between, insurers are driving down premiums by restricting the number of providers who will treat patients in their new health plans. So basically, you're running out of people who will see you at those reduced rates, which could in many cases force you to be put on Medicaid, essentially. And what we've seen long before Obamacare got put into place, the reimbursement rate there is so low that most doctors won't see Medicaid patients outside of the ER. So congratulations, America.
I nominated this as the good martini today, not because that it's good that low-income folks and working families will have fewer choices in under Obamacare. What is good about this is that the New York Times is recognizing this and felt that it realizes, hey, this is a very big deal. It's a big enough deal to put on page A1. And for a good portion of New York Times readers, you look at the polling numbers on Obamacare, there's still, you know, 30-some percent of Americans who think it's a good thing, and they support it, and they have this faith that it's all going to work out, it's going to be fine. But look, the exchanges are supposed to go into effect a week from now, and they're not going to be ready. And you start looking at, well, how does the Obamacare, you know, save people money? You could understand if it involved, say, tort reform and made every doctor not see a patient as a potential lawsuit. But no, that's not what's in place. Mostly what it is like, we're going to take all the really expensive doctors, we're going to cross them off the list. You can't go visit them anymore. And then of the ones who are left, we're just going to reimburse people fewer, whether it's, you know, hospitals or other places where they're providing care. Well, just arbitrarily saying we're not going to pay the doctors as much, I mean, that's one way to cut costs, I suppose, except that kind of basically makes the argument that, you know, assumes that you'll find enough doctors who are willing to provide the exact same quality of care for a lower price. And in most cases, you can't find that. So good news in that the flaws of Obamacare are coming crystal clear as we approach the deadline. And maybe this will force the folks on the left to recognize this is not a time for a faith-based claim that it's all going to turn out okay. Obamacare is a disaster. The train wreck metaphor of Max Baucus is perfectly accurate. And it may be a point where, you know, at some point, the more the Democrats insist everything is fine, the more they're going to come across as Chip Diller in the end of Animal House, insisting all is well as chaos, you know, consumes him. That's where the administration is on Obamacare. It's nice to see the front page of the New York Times exhibiting that all is not as they say.
On to the bad martini now. And I think most folks are aware of at least one of these stories, if not both of them, over the weekend. The event in Nairobi, the terrorist attacks at the mall there, the Westgate Mall, still going on. Apparently, there's quite a bit of action there this morning, so we'll see if it comes to a resolution today. But right now, the death toll is at 62 people, 200 wounded, 63 still missing. So both of those numbers on the death toll and the injuries could rise. The very same time over the weekend, two suicide bombers in Pakistan blew up a group of Christians right after Sunday services, 85 people dead there. Pakistani Taliban taking credit for that one. Al-Shabaab, which is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, taking blame or credit or however they want to put it for the mall attack in Kenya. And in a very weird twist, three Americans are apparently part of the terrorists there, obviously have been radicalized at some point. So Jim, once again, the narrative that was used last year that Al-Qaeda and terrorists are on the run, sadly not true.
It is very frustrating, horrifying to see this kind of bloodshed. It sounds like quite a few innocent men, women, and children were killed in both the Pakistan attack and the one over in Africa. And we're really at a point where we realize the U.S. cannot be everywhere. We cannot be the world's policeman, but it doesn't mean that, you know, Al-Qaeda and its allied groups are not on the loose everywhere. And if they can target Christians, they'll target Christians. If they can target, you know, non-Muslims, they will target non-Muslims. And if they can target Americans, they'll target Americans. So I saw some reports indicating the Israelis were giving help to the police forces outside the shopping mall and kind of trying to do their part to help get the innocent people out of the Westgate Mall. It's one of those things where, in the context of Syria, we saw a lot of people kind of arguing, you know, why is this our problem? Why do we have to deal with this? This isolationist impulse of, look, this is not our problem. The world has to solve its own problems. The good guys in Nairobi are doing their best job they can. But ultimately, anytime I think there's no people who are willing to slaughter women and children in a shopping mall and blow up a church in Pakistan, I think we ought to do what we can, which may not be necessarily send troops everywhere. But, you know, in a case where if we could help the Kenyan police and military forces in, you know, counterterrorism tactics and things like that, I think we ought to be doing that. So the jihad against Christians and against non-Muslims continues. And I think we kind of are whistling past the graveyard if we try to pretend that, well, if it's happening in far off countries, it's not our problem and not something we have to worry about. If for no other reason, then, you know, we want a world in which there is as little terrorism as possible, in which we don't have to constantly think about large swaths of the world as being fundamentally unsafe from, you know, large, coordinated, vicious and bloody terror attacks like this one.
On to martini number three now. And Sunday was the memorial service near the Washington Navy Yard for the 12 people killed last Monday. President spent 20 minutes in his speech, 8.5 of it, and there were other references to gun control elsewhere in the speech, 8.5 of it towards the end was directly referring to his ongoing pitch for gun control. Here's a couple of extended clips, the second of which I think most folks will probably find more galling.
What makes us so susceptible to so many mass shootings is that we don't do enough. We don't take the basic common sense actions to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and dangerous people. What's different in America is it's easy to get your hands on a gun. And a lot of us know this. But the politics are difficult, as we saw again this spring. And that's sometimes where the resignation comes from, the sense that our politics are frozen and that nothing will change. But the question is, do we care enough? Do we care enough to keep standing up for the country that we know is possible, even if it's hard, and even if it's politically uncomfortable? Do we care enough to sustain the passion and the pressure to make our communities safer and our country safer? Do we care enough to do everything we can to spare other families the pain that is felt here today?
So Jim, there in the first bite, you have him making the contention that there weren't already laws in place that should have prevented the shooting from taking place. And the second one, I think, will offend even more people, in that if you truly care about the people who were killed, then you'll adopt his approach to it.
Yeah, this is kind of the distilled essence of Obama. And I guess it's very interesting, 5 years into his presidency, if he'd been a similar circumstance in his first year in office, I think we all might have reacted with more shock and horror and more objection that he is kind of blatantly politicizing these deaths over at the Navy Yard and basically claiming that, you know, well, something terrible has happened and the answer is to vote for my agenda and to pressure Congress to support the bills that I support. In this case, you know, like this is a guy who's had several violent incidents, but yet never got prosecuted for it or never got put up on charges on it. If he had, it would have limited his ability to purchase a firearm because he didn't. Shooting out the tires and his other incident of shooting through the ceiling and all of those things should have put him on the watch list, but it didn't. So I don't understand how, you know, when you have somebody slipping through the cracks like this, the better job is to stop guys from slipping through the cracks. It's not to pass a whole new law on a system that isn't doing a good job with the laws that are already on the books. But we know this, and Obama is all about himself. This is, you know, all about pass what I want. And kind of the cherry on top in terms of demagoguery is boil it down to a matter of caring versus not caring. He cares, Greg. His congressional supporters care about it, but everybody who disagrees, they don't care, which is, you know, abominable thing to say and a He sounded tired as he said that, Greg, and this is a tired argument. And it's a tired suggestion that, well, if we just pass another law, we won't have gun massacres anymore. When, you know, we could have exhibited this. This was a person who had clearly had very serious mental problems and who very clearly had a history of violent incidents and yet never found himself in front of a judge who could hold him accountable for those violent incidents and get him on the, you know, federal do not purchase a gun list. It's infuriating, it's frustrating, and it very much fits our crazy martini. But I have to say, Greg, I don't think we can call this a surprising turn of events anymore.
On a much happier note, if you want to learn a whole lot more about Jim Garrity, go to townhall.com. He was the subject of Lisa DePasquale's Dozen Questions, and you can learn all about his background, his interests, his dreams, all sorts of other things, his favorite Christmas toy even.
Indeed. You know, I appreciate all of that, Greg. It's worth noting you and I, despite really depressing news, are not really in a bad mood at all today. You're happy because the Bears beat the Steelers late last night, 40-23, and I'm happy because the Jets are 2-1. And that's not something we get to celebrate very often. And the rest of the D.C. area, however, is in, for those who don't live in the D.C. area, it is safe to say that coverage of the Redskins is treated as a much bigger deal than scandals, the economy, and perhaps an impending terror attack. If there were a terror attack in D.C., they would tell us which direction the poison gas was flowing and where we should evacuate after an update on the ACL of Robert Griffin III. That is just the tone of coverage and the intensity of coverage here. Well, if Redskins win, the news coverage for the entire week, not just about sports, about every topic in the news, can be manic. And if it's bad, it's depressive. Every time the Redskins win, the news coverage is, oh, we're going to win the Super Bowl. And every time they lose, oh, we're never going to win again. Disband the franchise. Dan Snyder ruined the team. And so with three straight losses, I understand they're kind of like that. Remember that color-coded graph they had at the Department of Homeland Security extreme,
yes,
threat and all that stuff. My understanding is that they're actually now down to purple on the color-coded graph there, Greg, and it's down for suicidal, as depressed as they ever have been, I think, being 0-3 this year.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, you perfectly summed up the reason why I get very frustrated with the Redskins. The ups and downs is just too much to take, although listening to sports radio after they lose, if you're not a Redskins fan, can be really entertaining.
The spittle, you can actually, it's going to come through your speaker. That's how intense they are right now. They are not happy in the slightest.
Oh, well, I'm sure we made a lot of friends with those comments. But
I look, as a Jets fan, I sympathize. I'm going to gloat about our victories when I get them, because Lord knows I don't get it that often. Look, it'll turn around someday, Redskins fans. Someday.
Jim, very good. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and join us again Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.